Hello, my name is Tom Crofts and you're listening to the third of three podcasts exploring the practice of Buddhism in Britain today. In the first two programmes, we focused on the relevance of Buddhism to the individual and society at large. In doing so, we looked at the relevance of the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness and compassion. In this programme, we will be exploring the world of work and asking what the Buddha's teachings have to say about the way we interact with each other in the work environment. For those of us who are lucky enough to have jobs in the present economic climate, work probably takes up the bulk of our daily life, and certainly much, if not most, of our energy. The average Briton works about 35 hours a week. This includes the figures for part-time work, meaning that many people in full-time employment consistently work over 35 hours a week. That's a considerable amount of time, and for many of us, whether we are happy at work has a direct effect on whether we are happy in life in general. Work is an unavoidable necessity for everyone. At the very least, we all have to feed and clean ourselves, keep our affairs in order, and look after our children or parents. Most of us also need to work to earn money to live, and even if we dream of winning the lottery and retiring early, for most people, doing a job is ultimately a beneficial and rewarding pursuit. But our relationship with work goes deeper than this. For most of us, our self-esteem, happiness, and vitality are intimately bound up with our work life. Anyone who's ever been out of work will know what a negative and demoralising effect it can have. Work is also a primary part of our identity. When we meet people, one of the first questions we tend to ask is what they do for a living. And most of us seek out work that is interesting, challenging, and which stimulates us to fulfil our potential as productive members of society. For many of us, the sphere of work is also where we make our mark on the world, an arena where we can make a difference, where we are respected, and from which we derive our status. Many people are happy at work because it's a place where they are recognised, needed, and rewarded. Our motivations for working may be different. Some of us work primarily for money, some of us do it out of a pure love of what we do, and some of us are driven by ideological motivations. But whatever we do, however grand or humble, most of us have a fundamental need to feel valued for what we contribute. And if nothing else, work is what stops us getting bored, lonely and depressed. But for all the same reasons why work can be good, it can also be very challenging. Pride and ambition can lead us to invest so heavily in our careers that we are almost bound to face disappointment. And even if we get our dream job, we are likely to face stress and pressure, which has real consequences for our health. A 25-year study by the University College London, monitoring over 10,000 civil servants, suggested that working more than 11 hours a day increases the risk of heart disease by 67% compared to those who work a standard 7 or 8 hour day. We don't just suffer from our overwork at the physical level either. By overinvesting in our work, our emotional lives often suffer. The modern white-collar worker spends most of his time in front of a computer, which reduces his contact with other people and can be alienating. Our days often consist of thousands of abstract and often repetitive microtasks that have little to do with any direct human or life support function. When we spend more time in the office, we spend correspondingly less time with our family and friends. Indeed, many people use work as an escape route from pressures at home. And if we're really honest, we probably have to admit that work also entails many negative emotions, including those of anger, fear, and meaninglessness. It has become fashionable since the Second World War for ordinary people, both men and women, to work very hard to pay our mortgages and sustain our consumer habits. We all want to eat well, do up our houses, go on holidays, wear nice clothes, buy ourselves gadgets and so on. Working long hours is sometimes worn as a badge of honour in a macho culture where stamina wins respect regardless of the cost. We also tend to hanker after the recognition we gain from our jobs and the status they confer on us, whether this is making a fortune or saving the world, or being famous. All of this is well and good within reason, but the culture of work and an economic model based on continual growth has bound us into a socially self-reinforcing form of workaholism. Every hiring manager is looking for that passion, enthusiasm and dedication in its staff, even those doing the most mundane and menial jobs. You're expected to be driven and often to put corporate priorities ahead of our own. While the laptop and the mobile phone have enabled flexible working, they have also blurred the boundary between our life at work and our life outside, and in some cases, it goes too far. On the 9th of February 2007, Matthew Courtney, a 27-year-old Oxford-educated lawyer working for Freshfields, Brookhouse, Derringer, one of the so-called magic circle of leading corporate law firms, committed suicide by jumping from a stairwell in the Tate Modern. The Times Online reported that as a trainee he would have been expected to work up to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, in the hope of eventually being rewarded with a partnership and a £1 million salary. To commit suicide over work is unusual, but not unknown. Superficially, it is hard to understand why anyone would choose to end their life rather than give up a job that was proving too stressful. But when any activity becomes compulsive, it can take on an internal logic of its own that leads to extreme views. One of those extremes is the polarity between being and doing. We have come to value doing so much of being that we've lost the ability to be still, to contemplate and reflect, to appreciate nature, beauty and art. Our attention spans have become so short, it is hardly surprising that we end up emotionally diminished and spiritually unfulfilled. To see and engage with the deeper truths of life often requires us to stand back and observe patterns and mental tendencies that are subtle and easily get drowned out in the hubbub of a busy day job. In the Karaniya Metta Sutta, one of the Buddha's most important utterances on compassion, the Buddha directs the spiritual aspirant to be contented, easily supported, with few duties and light livelihood. This advice, of course, was dispensed in very different cultural times to our own. Like our own times, ancient India must have had an economic surplus to support activities outside of subsistence farming. But, unlike our own times, part of that surplus was commonly used to support itinerant monks who depended on lay followers and householders in the community to feed and clothe them. Today in the West, we have no culture of supporting those who choose to go forth from the household life to pursue spiritual practice. The climatic conditions do not support year-round living in forests and outdoors. So the modern British Buddhist has to work with all the joys and frustrations that go with it. While the Buddha encouraged people to choose work that allowed time for spiritual practice, he was not against work per se. Indeed, one of the central tenets of Buddhism is the so-called Noble Eightfold Path, which sets out the conditions for the path leading to enlightenment, and which is often represented visually by a wheel with eight spokes. One of those spokes is the injunction to practice what the Buddha called right livelihood. Primarily, this meant avoiding unethical livelihoods, which for Buddhists would include trade in dead animals, weapons and intoxicants and so forth. So if, as we've discovered in the previous podcasts, mindfulness is critical to our mental states and compassion is critical to our emotional states, then ethics is their practical culmination in the workplace. And one reason why work is so important is that it is the arena par excellence where we are called on to exercise ethical discernment. The workplace is loaded with ethical dilemmas. How do we respond to rude emails? How do we deal compassionately with staff who habitually underperform? How do we respond when we encounter bullying, harassment, prejudice? How do we treat staff who become sick or injured at work? How do we deal with drug and alcohol abuse when it affects the workplace? Teams and organisations that work well can unleash confidence, creativity and energy in ways that are almost impossible on the individual level. Together, we can build the tallest buildings in the world, fly to the moon, discover cures for diseases and penetrate the mysteries of the physical universe. But where organisations are rotten, where teams do not pull together, where there is intolerance and bullying, work can also become a living hell. Work is also a place where conflict arises, although often this is submerged or frozen. So how can we integrate ethics into our behaviour at work as the Buddha directed? To answer this and explore the themes of Buddhism at work, I spoke to Sadaraja, an order member in the Triratna Buddhist community who works in the HR department of Windhorse Evolution, a so-called team-based right livelihood business based in Cambridge. And I started by asking exactly what team-based right livelihood was.
Really, first of all, it's practicing right livelihood. That is a form of skillful livelihood. That is work as a practice, but using the team format as opposed to working on your own. Sangharakshita gives four definitions of what team-based right livelihood is. And the first of them is that the business is run on ethical lines. So the five precepts are the guide with team-based right livelihood. The second one is that the business provides enough remuneration for those workers working with it to allow a reasonable standard of living. The third one is that the business provides a framework of spiritual practice. So that aids the deepening of grace refuge for the people working within it. And particularly, as part of that spiritual practice, it emphasises friendship within the business. And then lastly, the business should make a profit, so that part of the profit can be given away as dana, as generosity, to worthy projects for altruistic activity.
Well, of course, that all sounds very well in principle, but does it actually deliver on the bottom line?
Yeah, I think it does. In terms of growth, it means that teams can help with blind spots and shortcomings, which, if you're working on your own, can go really unnoticed. And in terms of effectiveness, well, I think in modern life, in business today, there are two extremes that we've got to try and avoid. One of them is paranoid anxiety. The second one is naive optimism. And you see these a lot in modern business today. Businesses are very, you know, employees and staff are very, very paranoid. They're very, very anxious. Everybody's anxious. Anxious for the future of the business. Is it going to make enough money? Are we going to keep our employees? And that leads to a lot of stress. With naive optimism, that tends to lead to a failed business. Businesses are coming into being all the time and going out of being very quickly in the high street, on the internet, wherever. It's constantly happening. So these are kind of two extremes, I think. And I think what the team-based right livelihood model can offer is what we call in Buddhism a middle way. We're not falling into the paranoid anxiety that many businesses fall into. And hopefully we're able to maintain a positive concern and regard and awareness of our business, what we need to be aware of. The second time, we're not being naively optimistic. So I think it can really deliver on the bottom line. I think there's something to really be said for it. Our business is still within business. It's still growing. And I think that model can be improved and endlessly developed. And I think it can be grown and spread throughout the Buddhist world. So yes, we're practicing in the marketplace. We're out there on the high street every day. Our shops open 7 days a week, and we're trading. We turn over many millions of pounds a year. We offer employment to around 250 staff.
So do you have to be working in a team-based right livelihood business to be practicing Buddhism in the workplace, or can you practice it in any workplace?
Buddhism can be practiced by anybody, regardless of whether they work in Buddhist right livelihood or not. Everyone can practice Buddhism if they want to. Obviously, the job that you're doing will have an effect on your work. If it's very, very unskillful in some way, involves a lot of killing and that kind, or a lot of telling of lies and that kind of thing, it's going to be more difficult. But it doesn't mean to say that it's impossible. When I first got involved in Buddhism, my own work wasn't particularly skillful. But it didn't mean I couldn't grow. It meant I had to change that work and improve that work as time went by. I used to work in advertising, so I was required to tell quite a lot of lies, actually, and exaggerate things. Now, Buddhism can be practiced by anybody on the planet, but obviously your work is a big part of your life. Probably most people spend a third of their lives, waking lives at work. So obviously that's going to have a very strong effect on the mind. So sooner or later, you need to look at that, the kind of work that you're doing, and can that be improved either through the actual work you do or the way that you do the work that you're currently doing.
So why do ethics in particular matter so much in the workplace?
I think I've got three reasons. The first one is the global moving away from exploitation. Because of the internet and improved media, I think as a society, we're all much more aware of what we buy, what we produce in the world, where it all comes from, and we're much more aware of the world of fair trade and ethical trade in a way we didn't used to be. People don't want to feel that their company is involved in exploitation and harm. It's a more interconnected planet these days. The second one is the whole area of trust. I think trust is a really, really important 21st century issue in business and within society. Trust being really about ethics, particularly about a person's character, and secondly about their competence. How ethical is a person, and how competent are they at their job? And trust is really important in terms of an organisation and a business. If we have trust within a business, things can be effective. They can be cheaper, they can be faster, and they can be more pleasant. If you're working in a company where you trust your colleagues and your boss because you know they're ethical, they're kindly, they're generous, they're truthful in their speech, they're aware of others, it makes quite a difference to the workplace. Which brings me to the third point, the third reason why I think ethics is important, and that's employee happiness. Employee happiness and well-being is another important 21st century concern, the workplace. It's really about mental states. If you enjoy your job and you're happy there, you'll perform better in your work and you'll be nicer to have around. Probably you'll be healthier as well. Probably you'll be happier at home than the rest of your life. And I think ethics has quite a big effect in terms of employee happiness. It's about the culture, I think, in an organisation or a business. So if you're working in a business where people are skillful in their speech as opposed to unskillful, swearing a lot, gossiping, being really harsh in the way they talk about others, it all has an effect. If people are generous and honest, it means that you haven't got to be watching out all the time. People tell the truth at work. It means that customers, other employees can trust you more.
So in a Buddhist context, how do you deal compassionately with some of those really tricky management challenges like continual absenteeism or poor performance?
Well, I work in human resources, so this is an area I know quite a bit about, really. Basically, we've got a two-pronged approach. Once again, using two Buddhist practices, the first one is compassion, the second one is wisdom. So what compassion really means is we need to flag up concerns that we have with individual employees and with teams. We need to flag that up and offer them help. Our principles really here are reasonableness and responsibility. So we wish to empower employees to take responsibility for their employee habits, particularly their health, their conduct at work, you know, how they conduct themselves within the business. So timekeeping, for instance, is very good, you know, an important example. Someone is habitually late or absent without leave, or the performance is poor, then we need to let them know about that, and we do that. We hope to do that in a compassionate and sensitive way, and not in terms of punishment, and we offer them help, but also we'll be looking for employee effort. In terms of the wisdom side of it, we also need to impose boundaries and discipline. We're running a business and there are limits, actually. Sometimes individuals step over those boundaries, and where that happens, well, we have to impose a disciplinary procedure. And that's usually a three-stage disciplinary procedure. Once it goes beyond the third stage, then we have to end the employer-employee relationship. There's lots of kind of opportunity for individuals there to take responsibility for their behaviour.
Well, that brings us to the end of this series of three podcasts exploring the relevance of Buddhism in Britain today. I think what I've really learned over this series is just how interlinked all these issues are, how the individual and his or her own mental states affect other people, and how other people affect the mental states of the individual. And in particular, how awareness, compassion, and ethical sensitivity reinforce each other in a virtuous circle against the forces of habit and reflex responses, and allow for a richer, more fulfilling way of being.